This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Remember all those films you were shown in school that were supposed to teach you how to be a well-adapted, productive member of society, with good hygiene habits and a willingness to defer to authority? How about those old industrial films designed to sell luxury cars and deluxe refrigerators? Rick Prelinger has over 33,000 educational and industrial films in his archives. Films like Are You Ready for Marriage? Girls Beware, What It Means to Be an American, and The Wonderful World of Wash and Wear. He's curated an exhibition from his archives, which runs through the first part of next month at the American Museum of the Moving Image in New York. MTV, HBO, and the Comedy Channel often use his films for camp value or to help establish a historical period. Terry Gross spoke with Rick Prelinger, along with his colleague Ken Smith, who's researched the history of these films for a pending book. Let's start with an excerpt of the 1956 film Once Upon a Honeymoon, produced for Bell Telephone to sell new color phones.
Hello, yes, this is Mary. How are you? Bye.
They say your kitchen dazzles every eye.
A brand new sink, a built-in oven, a new refrigerator and a phone. A kitchen phone, a bright red phone. I gotta go, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. I'll call you later. Wish my living room were all redone. New drapes, new rugs, oh, this is fun. It's nice to have a telephone to blend with my new drapes and rugs. A living room that's all our own.
Rick Prelinger, what are we listening to?
Once Upon a Honeymoon is a Hollywood musical, but it's only 14 minutes long, and it was made to sell color telephones to the American public back in the 50s when they first became available. But Once Upon a Honeymoon is more than just a simple sales film. It flirts with fantasy and unreality, and also we're at a time when the telephone is no longer a necessity, that it's become a decorative accessory in the home. And you know, things like whim and choice and taste enter in for the first time.
Who was supposed to watch Once Upon a Honeymoon?
Once Upon a Honeymoon, like many of the sponsored films, was made to show a little bit in theaters, but mostly to kind of captive audiences and community groups and schools. And it was also made to show on TV in the days when the networks didn't run all the time, and there were a lot of holes in the schedule. So stations begged for films that had entertainment value.
Let me play an excerpt from another film in the Prelinger archives, and this is called Shy Guy. And in this film, a teenage boy is in his basement rebuilding radios and working on his oscilloscope, and he's afraid he doesn't fit in. So his father, dressed in his business suit, comes down into the basement and gives his son advice about how to fit in at school and how to become more popular like the other boys.
You know, when we moved here this summer, I had quite a time making friends in a new office where everybody else knew each other.
What'd you do, Dad?
Well, that's beside the point, son. What works for one doesn't necessarily work for another.
But I bet the other men didn't look at your clothes all the time.
Well, what makes you think they look at your clothes?
Oh, because the other fellas wear sweaters or just shirts, not a regular suit like mine.
Well, wear a sweater then. The clothes alone won't... Phil, what about the other fellows? What do they do? What do they like?
Gosh, Dad, I don't know. I never noticed. Only I know it's not radios.
Perhaps that's the reason you don't know. You don't notice what the others are interested in. Why not try to find out?
How, Dad?
Well, you might try watching, listening. Pick out the most popular boys and girls in school and keep an eye on them. Try to figure out why people like them. Not that you'll ever be just like any of them, but you might learn something.
Now, where is this movie from?
That film was made in 1947 by Coronet Films. Coronet was one of the biggest, in fact, the biggest producer of social guidance films at that time. Social guidance films came in after World War II because Parents and educators were very concerned that the kids at that time would become another lost generation as they had after World War I. So they decided to use the most modern scientific teaching tool they had available, and that was film. And so they made hundreds of social guidance films, and Shy Guy was one of the first.
This film and several other films that I've seen from your collection seem to be intent on teaching family values, teaching how you're supposed to behave with your peers and how you're supposed to behave with your family.
Well, that's very true. They were trying to teach kids how to not be adults as they had been during the war. There was again a great fear that kids would get out of control. And Shy Guy's notable. Well, it's notable for a couple of reasons. First of all, it stars Dick York in one of his earliest appearances.
The co-star of Bewitched.
Bewitched, yes. And second of all, it was probably the first film that encouraged kids to look around them and try and fit in with their peers. This was a theme that ran through many of the social guidance films, and actually it kind of backfired because while adults were trying to get kids to fit in, what the kids were really doing were listening to each other instead of the adults.
That's an interesting point.
And then once the late 50s came around, things kind of got out of control.
Do you think the secret message of this film is conformity?
It was. It was definitely, to conform was to be safe. To fit in was desirable. You didn't want to stand out. Standing out meant you were different and weird, and they didn't want that.
Well, that leads me to another film in your collection, A Date with the Family. And this film is supposed to show you how a good nuclear family should handle family dinner when dad comes home from work. And the emphasis is on how family dinner can be warm and fun if everybody cooperates and participates. Why don't we hear an excerpt?
Well, the dinner date has begun, and they're all happy about it. Napkins on the lap, the family awaits service. They converse pleasantly while Dad serves. I said pleasantly, for that is the keynote at dinner time. It is not only good manners, but good sense. Pleasant, unemotional conversation helps digestion. Father serves mother first, then daughter. Then the boys. Don't worry, fellas, you won't get left. By example, older children can teach younger ones good table manners. No one starts eating until father has served himself. Always wait for the hostess, in this case mother, to begin eating before you start. Let father and mother guide the conversational trend if they desire. After all, they made all this possible and may want to talk over their day with each other. Tell mother how good the food is. Maybe sis rates a compliment too. It makes them want to continue pleasing you.
Now, when is this film from? And is this one of those social guidance films?
This is another social guidance film. It was made in 1950. Actually, it looks like it was made probably about 1930. Its style is so stilted. It's also very typical in that the actors have nothing to say. It's completely without live sound. It's all done with a narration. And that was very typical of social guidance films. It was this kind of omnipotent voice of God. And what a child was supposed to do, you weren't supposed to think for yourself. There were just a certain set of rules. And once you memorize those rules, that's all you needed to know. Then you would fit in, and then life would run very smoothly, and you'd be very happy.
I think this film shows how much discontent must have been seething beneath the surface. Because if you had to make movies to convince people that family dinner could be fun, family dinner could be a good thing, it had to mean that a lot of people were really alienated from family dinner.
Well, you know, that film actually proposes that you lie and that you be dishonest, that you greet your dad as though you were genuinely glad to see him, as though you really missed being away from him.
Implying that you weren't genuinely glad to see him.
Right, and implying that the best family values, so to speak, are based on not speaking frankly to one another. One of the secrets which I think these films reveal is that the 50s were a time filled with discontent and paranoia, not the 50s with a warm, soft glow.
Rick Preilinger, how did you start collecting these films? I never would have thought that somebody was amassing these films that everybody has forgotten.
I began as a film researcher about 10 years ago working on a project about sex and romance at mid-century. And very quickly, I discovered this whole universe of films. At first, social guidance films. Later on, the rest of the educationals and advertising films. And as time went on, I began to assemble a fairly large collection. You know, when you have one or two, there may be a gem, and they may be particularly revealing. But when you begin to put a lot together, the big themes begin to come out, and you begin to see, you know, that there are authors and that there's voices, and there's some very interesting things to see in these films.
What are some of the big themes that have emerged? And you've collected education films, social guidance films, industrials.
One of the themes which I think is most interesting is kind of the grooming of the perfect American consumer over time. The American consumer was constructed by some major corporations over time, and there's a lot of revealing evidence about how this was done in the films, how desire was created, how model buyers and model families were presented for us to emulate.
So when companies made industrials advertising their new products and showing what you were supposed to want next, who would they show it to?
There was, until recently, a fairly well-established circuit for showing sponsored films around the country. And it was an incredibly inexpensive means of reaching the public with a message that didn't last 30 seconds or 1 minute, but maybe 10 minutes or half an hour. Films like We Drivers, a safety film made by GM with a little bit of advertising in it, were seen by over 30 million people.
Where did they see them?
In the old days, they were shown in theaters, especially the newsreel theaters that used to clutter up downtown areas. They're gone now. In schools, in 4-H groups, granges, on shipboard, in prisons, women's groups.
Have you found a lot of producers, directors, actors who made industrials in the early part of their career and then became better known for Hollywood or television work?
Yes. As a matter of, well, of course, we've already mentioned Dick York and Shy Guy, the man who narrated that film. His name is Myron Walashinsky, and of course, we know him better now by his new name, which is Mike Wallace.
Are you kidding?
No, he that's where he got his start. So yes, it was a stepping stone for quite a few people because there were so many of these films made. Hundreds of thousands of these kinds of films were made. And any actor or narrator who wanted to support himself or herself, you know, did these films just to feed themselves.
I was also going to mention that Robert Altman got his start as a director at Calvin in Kansas City. And he made one film, which we have, which is astonishing, called The Magic Bond for VFW, which has a scene in it of G.I. sitting around in a foxhole, and it looks just like MASH.
Some of the films in your archive seem to be odes to the factory assembly line or exhortations to workers to get out there and work with good spirit and be productive. They almost remind me of what I think of as, like, you know, communist propaganda films, but instead of being about communism, they're about capitalism.
Well, I think that's very true. I call some of these films examples of capitalist realism because, in fact, the techniques of the Soviet cinema are being used to promote the American system here. From Dawn to Sunset, which is a film made in 1937, was made by General Motors right after the United Auto Workers successfully organized the first plants in Flint and around Detroit. And in a way, it's an attempt to deny that unions exist, because what it does is it shows a kind of circular relationship between workers and the company for whom they work. Workers become consumers rather than, dare I say, a class with any interests of their own. And it's, by omission, I think is trying to imply that unions are an unnecessary force.
Why don't we hear an excerpt of From Dawn to Sunset?
Follow the eastern sun as it rises on the homes of men along the great Atlantic seaboard. The morning light over the plains has waked the thousands who are off to enliven the factories of the vast Midwestern states. And along the sunny shores of the Pacific, men are on their way to quicken the beat of industry. In 12 great cities, located in every region of the country, the clans are gathering for the work of a new day. As the sun stretches fingers of light across the pavements, the early morning sparkles with the greeting of men to men. On their way to factories in Flint and Atlanta, from Tarrytown to Oakland, the neighborly workmen hail each other with the salute of fellowship.
Do you each have any personal favorites in the thousands of films in the Prelinger archives?
Well, my favorite social guidance film is probably, I think, everybody else's favorite, which is a film called Dating Do's and Don'ts. It was a film made by Cornette in 1949, and it basically takes you through a date step by step, presenting you with various alternatives as to the way you want to act. I mean, at the end, you know, Woody, who is the lead, he has the option of either lunging for the woman who he's saying goodnight to or shaking her hand. And of course, when he lunges, he's spurned, and when he shakes her hand, he is congratulated and walks off at the end whistling very happily.
But you know, it's so interesting because you're looking at a phony presentation of life that is actually very revealing about what real life was.
Well, you know, historians have often been caught up in kind of a trap of authenticity. If it isn't, you know, an exact record of a real historical event, it isn't important. And I would argue, on the contrary, that these films are all about what we received from the top down, how the media sent messages to people, how we were conditioned, trained, taught, and sold to, and what our aspirations and our feelings were over time. And I think that that's very important, because the history of the 20th century is, to a great extent, the history of the mass media. In addition, these films are also very interesting because they do picture life as it was. You can see the look of a street, and you can see average and ordinary families, and you can see, you know, very rich visual imagery that contains a lot of information. You wouldn't see it in a feature film that was more stylized. You wouldn't see it in a newsreel or an old TV show.
Film archivists Rick Prelinger and Ken Smith. Rick Prelinger is curating an exhibition from his archives at the American Museum of the Moving Image in New York. It runs through the beginning of next month.